Hallo, eine kurze Durchsage, ehe wir in das Interview mit Don Daglow springen. Fabian und ich haben das Gespräch auf Englisch geführt. Am Ende dieses Podcasts gibt es noch eine kurze Zusammenfassung auf Deutsch.
Another visitor. Stay a while. Stay forever.
Ein Podcast über alte Spiele von zwei alten Männern. Heute mit Gunnar Lott und Fabian Käufer.
Hello, this is Stay Forever and I am your host Gunnar. With me is, as usual, Fabian. Hi, Fabian.
Hi, Gunnar.
And, of course, our guest. We have the great honor to talk to Don Daglow. Don is somewhat of a legendary figure in the games industry. He has developed games for mainframe machines in the 70s, worked in television, where he became director of game development, worked at the early Electronic Arts and Broderbund. He founded his own studio, Stormfront, famously creating Neverwinter Nights, the first graphical MMORPG. He ran Stormfront for 20 years and in the last decade has been an independent advisor, freelance game designer, management advisor, and popular speaker at games industry conferences. He has held numerous roles in the games industry bodies over the times. These days, he's the president of the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences Foundation, and he is a best-selling author with an award-winning novel and an award-winning nonfiction book about how to create indie games. Welcome, Don.
It's great to be here. And yes, I did all those things. Really, I did. No, really, I did.
It has been a long introduction, so a rich working life. Don, we're here today to talk about Utopia, which is, in a way, if I may say so, the game that made your career. So if you were to describe that game to my 15-year-old daughter, who has played Minecraft and other games but never heard of Utopia, what would you say?
I would say that Utopia looks like a game with very blocky graphics, and it looks like a board game come to life in which the two players are managing two islands and trying to have the most successful island.
The era of the Intellivision is more than 40 years in the past, so please take us back to when it started. How did you land the job at Mattel?
Well, Mattel, I don't know how great their distribution is in Europe. In the United States, they are one of the biggest toy companies. And when Atari brought out the Atari VCS, which later was renamed the Atari 2600, and it sold so well, Mattel said, aha, this is a new kind of toy. And toy companies, when there's a big new category of toys, toy companies want to get into it. So they ran a test market for a beautiful machine that was actually, by today's standards, it would be considered almost next gen, next to the Atari. Its cycle was about 3 years after the Atari. Or you could argue it was short of a full gen, but it was at least a half gen ahead, because 3 years of technical improvement had happened. And so it was also a fundamentally different hardware architecture. I'm oversimplifying here, but the Atari operated off of a signal where that would run down the screen over and over again each second. And then the graphics were interruptions in the signal, and you could control the color and the shape of them. But everything was being done on an analog basis by messing with the signals that would display graphics on a television screen. The Intellivision, being newer, was actually displaying graphics on the screen rather than using that technology. The other thing was different is that the Atari was based on the 6502 processor. That's the same processor that was inside the Commodore 64, that was inside the old Apple II, which was a very early market-leading processor. Really, the games industry started on 6502 machines, both computer games and the early video game home consoles. Intellivision used a GI-1610 chip, which actually, a lot of its functionality was 16-bit, not 8-bit. So I read articles now where Intellivision has leapt into the 8-bit category, But in actuality, it was a bridge between 8-bit and 16-bit machines. So Mattel goes and does this test marketing of a unit. The test market succeeds. And so they say, okay, we're going to bring this out. Now, they had used an outside group to do a few games for the test market. And now they said, okay, now we have to build our own group of video game designers because we're making video games. Just as this happens, as they start this process, we cut to another part of Southern California. A young man is driving home in his car from work. His work isn't going very well. He's an assistant superintendent of schools and a teacher. And it's very political and it's not very fun. And there are some nasty people around the schools. So the young man driving his car, who is devilishly good looking and very clever, the young man driving his car hears a radio ad on what today we would call a hip hop station, but this was 1980. So then it was Kindness, Joy, Love and Happiness, KJLH in Los Angeles, California, 102.1 FM. And so I'm driving along because I was the young man. And all of a sudden out of the radio, I swear, the radio said, would you like to work in the exciting world of video games? And I'd been writing games on mainframes, as you mentioned, for 9 years. And, you know, writing games was just part of me. And so I thought, yes, I would like to do that. Would you like to help shape the future of this exciting new medium? Why, yes, I would. And I always joke about it because I was driving a convertible and I did have the top off. So I always joke that I didn't know whether to look at, down at the radio or up at God because the announcer's voice sounded like God's voice talking to me. Then call 213-978-JOBS. That's 213-978-JOBS. All kidding aside, that call changed my life. That's why I still remember the number, what, 43 years later. But I called him up and said I'd been writing games for 9 years and programming. And at first they thought, oh, the things people say when they're applying for jobs, they lie. And then they realized I was telling the truth. So they called me in and I interviewed and I got the job. So on the first day of the Intellivision team inside Mattel, there were 5 programmers, a manager, and 4 of us who were the frontline programmers. And I got to go to the first team meeting on the first day and be part of that original team, which is just, I joke about it a lot, but that was incredible luck. That was incredible good fortune. What if I hadn't been listening to the radio that day?
Let's stay there for a moment at this exact point in time. What were the other guys like? How did you collaborate? How was work organized in that period?
So to give you an idea, going into Mattel, it's moved now, but the headquarters at that time was a 6-story building that was just south of the airport. And it was on the major freeway that runs by the airport. And that's a very convenient location for companies where they have a lot of people doing travel and so on. So you would drive up, park in the big parking lot, and walk into the security entry for the 6-story building. And there was high security there because in the toy industry, espionage was, and I presume still is, practiced routinely. So the major toy companies, and of course, I know nothing about this. This is all stuff I've read in books and heard about in podcasts. But the major toy companies would try to learn what the other companies were doing to avoid falling too far behind. And so at trade shows and things like that, they would be looking for ways to get into the secret briefings that retailers would get from the toy companies. So when we walked in, if you were a guest, you had to get past security, you know, get a name badge. That's very common now. But as employees, we had to wear a name badge, had our photo on it. The guards would check our photo against us every time we came in. And it also had a special color code that was our security clearance. So this is much more like walking into a military base than walking into a company. And we had the highest clearance of all, which was a yellow bar on the bottom. And then there was a little red plastic button that was punched into a hole on our badge. So somebody could try and make a fake badge reproducing the color, but they couldn't reproduce that weird round red button. And that's why that was the highest security class. And only we, as video game designers and the team of people around us and the toy designers, had that badge, and then the very senior managers. So no one else in the company could come to our area, and no one else in the company could go to the toy designers area. They actually had to come out to outer conference rooms to meet. And we had to escort people into our area to special conference rooms to meet. So if you walked in and you were a member of either the team that was doing the handheld games that Mattel had at that time, or if you were working on Intellivision, you started out in the 6-story tall building, but you didn't stay there. No. After you went through security, you turned right and you went through a big double doors and down the hallway of what had been a warehouse, a very, very big warehouse that was full of Mattel Toy Company stuff. And once you walked down a ways on the right, there were some partitions in different places making hallways that were about 8 feet high. And then there would be a door in one of those partitions, but the ceiling of the warehouse was much higher. So you would go through that door and you would come into our area. And just when I got there, they put in cubicles for us. What would look like pretty familiar looking, fairly small cubicles that would still be in use today in a cubicle environment. But around us, the warehouse continued to work. So you would hear from the hallway the as the guys who were driving these huge forklifts with and without different heavy steel boxes of stuff on them or big flat loads, they would be honking at people because they went through those hallways. And if we were walking down to their offices after lunch and a forklift came the other way, then you had to flatten yourself against the wall to get away so the forklift could come by. And that noise was always going on outside our offices. Across one of these hallways from the Intellivision and development space, we were called D&D for design and development for electronics. Across the hallway was the test lab for the Mattel Toy Company. So they would test all of the toys there in that lab, and they had the same 8-foot partitions underneath the tall roof. So if you were on that end of our space, you might hear,
"Hello, my name is Barbie,"
over and over again. Or you'd hear the sound of a Hot Wheels car being revved up 10,000 times on some device. And it was not super loud. It was distant enough. The upside of that was they had a dumpster that was in the hallway outside their door. And the hallway was wide enough that the forklifts could get past the dumpster. And they used a forklift to take it outside when it was full. And when they finished testing the toys, those toys had been beaten up. They couldn't sell them, so they would throw them out. And they had learned that if they threw the toys into the dumpster, well, everybody in the company knew where that dumpster was, and there were hundreds of people in this facility. So everybody had gotten used to coming down at their lunch break after work and dumpster diving for the toys. Well, Mattel didn't want all those toys going out because they were beaten up and worn out, and even if it was employees getting them, that damages the value of the brand because it makes the toys look bad. So the guys who were the toy testers, when they took them out of the dumpster, they would take them and they would smash the toys on the edge of the dumpster so that people wouldn't take them home. So what we all did instead is we did dumpster diving looking for something that hadn't been smashed so badly that we couldn't take it home. And I had 2 young kids at this point. I had a baby, and I started at Mattel. I had a 1-year-old, and then we had another baby while I was working there. So looking for things to take home to the little kids was fun. And I got a few things. There were some beautiful die-cast train cars that I got out of the very bottom of the dumpster. And I had to go all the way in. There was no way to smash them. And I don't know if they were prototypes for something. They were never sold by Mattel. But we had those train cars for quite a few years. You know, I had a speak and spell type toy where you dial up a sound and it says words with a sound. I had one of those for years. inside our space, very traditional cubicles. We had the industrial designers from the handheld game group in with us, which was great because on certain kinds of things, once in a while, we could really use their help. We had no artists yet. We only had game designers / programmers. So each of us was everything for a game. A specialized artist came later. And so you designed your game, you programmed your game, you did the art for your game. If you really got stuck, you could ask an industrial designer for help, but there wasn't a lot of time to do that. We were the be-all and end-all. And so we would have a computer working at our desk. And then we had dev kits for the Intellivision, obviously because it was a custom format. But there were more programmers than there were dev kits. When there were five of us, I think we had two dev kits. And so we had to keep swapping off and switching off of who could use the dev kit at any one time, which slowed all of us down. Then we got some more dev kits, but by then we had more programmers and so on and so on. So it was an eternal problem. So the dev kit stations were in cubicles by themselves, and then we would rotate into those cubicles. And then we would have our own cubicle with our own station. So I think those are kind of the highlights of what it was like in our first office. Later, we moved to another place in the facility that was a little nicer, but it was still a converted factory.
As you said, you came from developing games on mainframe computers, and you mentioned the dev kits that you had for the Intellivision. How much different was it developing for that home console now? Did you encounter many like technical problems in making the games work, and especially making Utopia work on this new platform?
Oh, I had so much to learn. My first project for Mattel was actually for a keyboard component that was like a home computer they were doing. And that I programmed in BASIC. That keyboard was test marketed, but never shipped. So that hardware and all the software exists only in test form. So that makes it by far the most expensive of the collectible pieces of Intellivision items that people go for. So when I switched over to the regular Intellivision, I don't know, 2 months into my time there, basically I had to learn GI 1610 assembly language, which is a lot like 68000 language, but 68000 came on later. So I basically had to learn that from scratch. And I had always been programming in high level languages like BASIC in particular, Pascal, a little bit of Snowball. Fortran, I will tell you, do never try to write a game in Fortran. It does not work. I mean, you can, but the language is trying to stop you at every moment. It's screaming, no, I'm a serious language. You cannot use me for a game. I refuse to help you. So Fortran was not the thing. But learning assembly language is very different because in assembly language, you are working on one byte at a time. And very often you're working on one bit at a time. This is something that in high-level languages and modern programming languages, if you want to look at C, C++, Python, you're never anywhere close. You're giving a command that will change lots of bytes all at once. You're doing things at a very high level. But in assembly, you are moving every byte into the registers, doing something to it, moving it somewhere else. So you are down deep in the details. And our cartridges were only 4K. So we had only 4,000 bytes. Now, we're all used to saying 8-bit, 16-bit. What was weird about the Intellivision is that our instruction set was 10 bits wide, which basically means the way people talk about it, in some ways it would be called a 10-bit machine, which is just very weird. But our registers, our RAM was 8-bit. So it made more sense for modern programmers. But it was a much more powerful system than the 6502 and the Atari. I'll tell you, I was scared stiff setting out to learn that. Having only worked in high-level languages, I had a smattering of exposure to 6502, not just mastery. I had nothing approaching useful knowledge. And so I was trained there, and I wrote Utopia. The first parts of Utopia I wrote as I was being taught the Intellivision system and the assembly language at the same time. I kept adding features to the game as I learned it, but I learned the Intellivision and I learned assembly as I created the game. So there were a lot of moments of sheer terror, to tell you the truth.
How was the game conceived? Was it entirely a one-man, one-game situation and they just went at you and said, you know, come up with something? Or did they have like a portfolio idea? We need one of those and one of those.
The manager of our group was a gentleman named Gabriel Baum. He and I are still friends, and this was in Southern California. We now live within an hour's drive of each other here up in Northern California. We had a great degree of independence in the electronics division for Mattel. And so the challenge that Gabriel was able to give us was come up with one or more proposals for games you'd like to do that you think would be good. Take a look at the kinds of things we have from the test marketing. Look at the things that the other guys are doing. You know, we're not trying to do a bunch of things that are all the same. We're trying to do a variety of titles. We started out with strength in sports because that was a lot of the demo stuff they had originally done were sports games. And so with Utopia, I was thinking, okay, we're working on a lot of arcade games because that was our big rivalry with Atari. We're working on sports games. So what can we do to augment that? And I started thinking about, well, if I'm trying to do something that will be very different from those things and help add variety to the line, then I started thinking of what turned out to be Utopia. And I've told the story quite a few times, but the basic roots of Utopia, so that it came readily to my mind, were when I was a teacher, I had used a game like that to help teach my kids the geography of the world. And I'd made the cafeteria of the school. I'd used electrical tape to make a map of the world on the cafeteria floor as a way to get a big enough map the kids could actually walk around it and get a feel for it. And I had seen a game, which was mostly a text game called Santa Praevia, which was really inspired by an earlier mainframe game called Hammurabi. And these were games that basically simulate how much grain you could grow in a year, and then how much money you could make out of that, and then could you build something in your kingdom with it. So that was the theme of those old mainframe games. And then the final piece of the puzzle that I was thinking about, because I was thinking, okay, this is great, but how do you do this on a 4K cartridge? And in the early 70s, I had seen an awful movie that was shown late night on TV called The Killer Shrews. This was a very low budget, early 1960s movie. And the idea was a testing of the atomic bomb had taken some little shrews, like little gophers. And instead of hunting bugs in tiny tunnels at night, now they had a desire for human flesh. And they were big. They were big as a, not as a bear, but they were big as a really large dog. And they traveled in packs and they were fearsome and they had huge, gigantic front teeth like oversized bunny rabbits. Awful movie. Basically, the entire plot is a handful of people are trapped in a building because the killer shrews have taken over this island and they have to figure out how to get to a boat to get away. And they do a lot of arguing and then there's romance and everything else, but it's basically hide in the building, get to the boat. And so I finished watching that movie one night, and this would have been 73, maybe 1973. And I thought that would make an interesting simulation game. So I started working on the mainframe and I made a game about the island and figured out, okay, well, on the timeline, how long would it take for the shrews to eat everything else on the island? Maybe there'd be rabbits and deer or forget what else. And, you know, you could pick then when you would try to go and would use the keys to try and guide yourself out of the building and down to the ship at a point where all the killer shrews were occupied somewhere else. And if you waited too long, it was much harder because then it was just random movement as they hunted for you and you had to pick the moments. This was not a sophisticated game. I'm not even sure it was a fun game. I only worked on it for a couple weeks, which was probably more hours than I should have. Once I discovered the computer, my grades went down for a while at school. But that idea of the island, because the island creates limits. You don't have to worry about borders or bounding things. You have that. And the water ties things in. So I wrote up a proposal to submit saying that this would be a strategy game, the Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York in the U.S. is where I've put all my papers. And they have a copy of the original proposal, which is printed on paper that's, what, 14 inches wide, computer paper with punch holes so it would roll through a printer. But the text on it is only, of the 14 inches, is only about 7 inches wide. And then the rest of the paper is all blank. So it looks very weird. But that was the printer we had to print on writing up something like this. So I just made the pitch for it. And I said, there will also be educational elements of this. But I know we're trying to sell the Intellivision as an arcade machine. So we don't have to say it. But as a teacher, I know there's educational elements in this. And I didn't have to submit another idea because they approved that one. And at that point, it was, okay, Don, start working on it.
What were you imagining, or what had you been told was the target audience?
It was such early days that all we knew about the target audience was that it was kids and families. And we didn't have a lot of data. So I was just trying to look for areas where no oil wells had been drilled, looking for pools of oil that nobody else was already tapping. That was an idea we were taught explicitly later in the early days of Electronic Arts. So that's what I was thinking of. And I saw it as a strategy game, because one of the things I very concretely thought about was on mainframes, most of the games we had were simulations of some kind and strategy games. But here, with the games that were going on in the first wave of video game consoles, they were arcade games, they were sports games. But a lot of the themes we had had on mainframes were not being explored. And so I thought of Utopia as being a simulation game, most of all. And after that being a strategy game, it ended up being in the strategy network, they called it, for Mattel. And I built educational elements into it because it was so natural. And I was a teacher. They never advertised it that way, but I think the company loved the fact when the game was introduced and we started getting reactions to it, that unofficial education content turned out to be a very big feature that people liked.
So you were not afraid at some point that people might be put off kind of like by the intellectual requirements of the game, because it's immensely more complex and demanding compared to the other simple arcade games that you had on the consoles at that time.
I think I was naive about that in some ways. Obviously, the game succeeded. It was not one of our three biggest bestsellers. It was our highest rated game. It won the most awards of all of our games, but it wasn't one of our three bestsellers. But I just thought, well, on the mainframe, these were games people loved. So if we're adding graphics, if it was cool in the mainframe, then people will probably like it now. And it was simple enough for kids to play. And frankly, naively, that was the extent of my thinking about it, because all the perspectives we have now and all the niches and micro analysis, there's a very large game that I'll be able to talk about soon, but big cross-platform current gen title I've worked on in a small role, a very fun role, but small role over the last couple of years. And if you look at the amount of work, analysis, and focus that goes into that title compared to what we were doing, we look like five-year-olds wandering around in the kindergarten.
The Intellivision had a very unique controller and unique scheme of controlling games. So could you elaborate a little bit on that, how you used that on Utopia and how you were introduced to that system?
First of all, what's interesting now, historically, people look back at that controller, and as you said, they say, that's a weird controller, mister. But back then, there were a variety of controllers that were out there. So if you look at the consoles of the 70s and the early 80s, the ones that succeeded and the ones that did not, you've got a variety of controllers. This is a case of, I don't know, it's like looking at the map of Germany in 1779, and then looking at it again in 1870. In 1870, it's all joysticks, but you still have the Grand Duke of different kinds of controllers all over. in the 18th century. So that may not be the world's best metaphor for describing hand controllers in terms of the development of the German state, but it's only in retrospect that it was weird. So for those who have not seen it, the Intellivision controller had a number pad laid out very similarly to the way the numbers are on your mobile phone. But this is not a touchscreen. This is way before touchscreens. This is, what, 35 years before anything with a touchscreen. So they were little bumps. There was a little metal plate, very thin, and it had little domes for each number. And as you pressed down on that dome, you were pressing the switch and it would connect. And so each of those was a button for each number. There were four buttons on the side, two on each side, and they mapped as two buttons. So there were two instances of each of two buttons. And then at the bottom of the hand controller, which had a footprint not too different from your mobile phone now, was a round little hard plastic plate colored gold. And that plate sat on a central spindle and was held in by the casing. So you could press on the disc, which is what it was called, and you could run your finger around it in a circle. And there were, I'm trying to remember how more, I think there were 16 contacts in it. So it broke the circle up into 16 different spots. So what you would do in playing is you would have one hand with your thumb over where all the buttons were, and you would have the other thumb over the disc at the bottom. The disc was a variation on the joystick, but it gave you the same kind of control. We felt it was more accurate. Obviously, we were prejudiced, but we felt it was more accurate than the Atari joystick. And with that two-hand process, you actually had more options of controls you could give your player than we have by some definitions on modern controllers. Mattel then had little plastic overlays that would slide over the buttons on top, and they would have graphics on it to show you what that button was in that game. Once people learned the games, they would take the overlays out and just play by feel on the button. But the overlays were a great teaching tool while somebody learned the game. And so to design Utopia, the first thing I thought about was, okay, what will I do with the disc, which would function as an analog joystick would function now? And what would I do with those 12 buttons up on top? So the layout of having one feature you could add to your island per button was a natural. And then using the disc to control where on your island you were building was a natural. And then later when we added fishing boats and PT boats, controlling them was a natural as well.
You have six buildings and the rebel and the two boats. So that's nine items. And that exactly maps to the controller. So is this a design restraint? You had like nine moving pieces. This was the maximum in the game?
That was a design constraint, but I'll tell you, it did not feel like a constraint at the time, because just doing it, it was such early days. And I will tell you, I got up every morning and I would just look up and say, God, I don't know what I did right, but thank you. How did I end up here? And I was having so much fun. And it was such a great team around me. And after a few months, we started to add people to the team and it started to grow. Gabriel Baum, in terms of a manager, I reported directly to is the best boss I ever have had in my career, where I was actually an employee reporting to somebody. And obviously I've spent a lot of years where I was a studio GM or a CEO or whatever, but you know, I had what turns out to be the best boss of my career. I was surrounded by some really wonderful people. And we were just having a great time. And so I looked at that and I thought, you know what? That's about the right amount of complexity. I think this feels right. And I think one of the dangers, one of the things I teach now when I visit universities and talk about game design, is that simplicity is a great goal of the game designer, because the more complexity you add to a game, the more you risk confusing your player or producing only an elite group who are the only ones who can play your game. And if you really want to reach people and entertain them, which is our goal, complexity may make you feel smart, but it makes our player feel dumb. And that's not a good thing. So the complexity that the hand controller suggested, I continue to believe was the right complexity for the game. And I know I had ideas. Oh, I could add this. I could add that. If we had more buttons, we could do this or that. I was not heartbroken about that because, you know, I was relying entirely on my experience of all those games on the mainframes, and their simplicity was also necessary for a variety of reasons. So I did not feel hindered by it. Now, 4K memory limitation, we spent more time compressing our code than we actually spent coding our game and designing a game just to get it to fit in 4K. But that was the boogeyman. The hand controller, I still believe, was a beautiful, elegant piece. People are now taught in design classes that it's a bad controller. I respectfully disagree because at the time, people loved it. But history has said that only joysticks are cool and only modern console controllers are cool. So, you know, it's a battle I'm never going to win in the public eye because people are already being taught in school it's bad.
I used that controller in like 1984. So I have firsthand memories and I found it impressive because it felt like a real thing for gamers and not like the kiddie stuff with the VCS. So for what it's worth. So
I've always thought you were a brilliant man, and this just reinforces my opinion.
You just mentioned the boats that you have in the game, and you also mentioned that you categorized the game as a strategy game, but you added in these what we call real-time strategy elements later in the game. How did you come up with these?
First, I got the strategy part going. You would put things down. Both players would, at the same time, simultaneously build things. But there was a time limit to the turn that you could control. And when the turn was over, the system would then compute the score for each island based upon the happiness and the well-being of the people. And we got that going, or I got that going. I'm so used to saying we from the modern games industry for the last 35 years, but I got that going. And we all agreed it was fun. And people said, we need more to do, though. I mean, when you finish your turn, exactly as you said, you're just sitting there waiting for the time to be over. What else could you do? And that's when I came up with the fishing boats and then the PT boats. So it was get your stuff built early in the turn, do your building, and then use the rest of the times to try and get more earnings with your boats. And if you had boats that were in peril from pirates or from your opponent, then you were going to be distracted from your building time. Then you'd have to try and manage that and then get back in time to build before the time was up. And so that's where the real-time strategy element of the game came from.
Let's talk a little bit about Utopia being a two-player game, which is not as unusual as it seems from our perspective. Most games on early consoles were like sports games, especially were two-player games. But this is handled slightly weird. So it's a two-player game at heart, and you can leave one island sitting and just go for the point optimization, and then you have a one-player game. So was this a conscious decision, so to have a two-player game at first or to support the concept? Or how did this come about?
In television's mindset, and you hit the nail on the head, this is the case for a lot at Atari as well, not everything, but was that two-player? Well, you had to have somebody to play with because the systems were too primitive to do much of an AI opponent. In 4K, you were not going to get an AI opponent in that space. The team used to kid me mercilessly because they gave me the supposed award, which never had a physical form, as the programmer who in the history of video game design wrote the most pages of computer code in assembly language that did absolutely nothing. Because if you printed out the code, there were about 3 pages of instructions to calculate the score at the end of a turn. And only then, all it did was update the scores. And especially the guys who were computer science majors, who were going to do everything more compactly than I would, they loved, because they knew it bothered me, they would used to kid me mercilessly. 3 pages, and it doesn't do anything that you can see on the screen. What an accomplishment, Don. But yeah, for those reasons, there was no opponent. So that was the mentality built into the box. We bought into it as designers. Marketing bought into it. I think the audience did. We had data that said an overwhelming majority of our players played two player, not one player. So we had that market feedback data. So I just naturally thought of it that way. But then, of course, if you wanted to just play one side, especially if you're trying to figure out how to kill your brother in the game and get really good, you could play lots of practice games solo, then use that knowledge to crush your brother.
But given that it was mainly a two-player game, I guess you had also to spend a lot of time on the balancing of the game, because there are certain randomized elements in the game, like the thunderclouds or the stock of fish appearing. And wasn't it like really hard to make it a fair game for two players?
I don't know if any of this survived and got into the papers I gave to the museum. But the last month I was working on the game, I start pitching the concept, I think, in March. And the game went final in mid-November of 81. And then was approved for manufacturing, which itself would take several months. You know, you're going through, you've got bugs and you're trying to fix your bugs. You've got your bug list. But I spent much of the last month with a yellow pad next to me. And then I'd run out of paper in the pad. I'd be using the back of things or whatever else. I would be playing the game over and over and over and watching the storms come down and counting how many times each square was touched by a storm, and having the hurricanes separate since they were damaging, and how many total hit points went onto each island so that both the damage and the positive of storms would even out. And of course, it was pretty good. I got it to be pretty good fast. But once I started to stabilize it, it was still... The left island got a little more damage, but it also got a little more rain than the right island. And that was enough that you didn't want to play the right island. Even allowing for the greater damage, you wanted to play the left island. Okay, tweak the algorithm to make it more likely, because basically the storms came down. My first version was look at the aspect ratio of the screen, try to mimic that so storms would wobble off of a line that would go directly down the middle of each island and make everything even. And that got pretty close. Okay, well, I need to wobble a little more to the right. Okay, fool with it. Play five more games. It's still a little short. Okay, a little more to the right. Five more games. Oh, now it's too far to the right. Oh, no. Now the right's way better. Okay. Oh, I did it over and over again. Hashtag marking. Click, 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 cross. Click, 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 cross. You know, taking graph paper, drawing out the islands, and then marking on each one each time something hit it over and over again. And I will tell you, by early November of 1981, I was sick of doing that, of just sitting and watching storms move.
With the benefit of hindsight, are there things you wish you had done differently in the game? And expanding, did you ever consider to go back to the game and develop, you know, a modern version, a sequel, whatever?
You know, I've thought about that a lot over the years. It's never actually happened. Maybe someday it will. But I've thought about it a lot over the years because I absolutely still love the game. I'm very proud of it. I think people who played mainframe games in the 70s, of whom there are not very many, probably can look at it and see its roots in mainframe games, but with the graphics now added of a quote-unquote modern 1980s game console. I've done a lot of other simulation games in the meantime, and I would think about, because when you're building role-playing games, you're doing things like creating economies. You're doing some of these same things, but you're doing it now in a world that a player walks through rather than a static board-type setting like Utopia. But I had very few regrets on that game, apart from, well, later we got 8K cartridges. And then they think, oh, if we had 8K, oh, now what I could have done.
Four Island.
Yes. And then we got 16K cartridges with bank switching, but that had all of its own problems. But no, I was pretty content with the game. And when it was introduced, it had a weird experience. So 1982, Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas is where it was introduced for the first time and shown. So we go for the first day of the show, and, you know, we're doing like volunteering, working in the booth, showing games to people. And we would not only show our own game, but we'd show other people's games. We kind of rotated the stuff. And press people would come by, retailers, competitors. I'm getting up the second morning of CES. So this would be January of 82. And my wife calls me at the hotel. So this is before cell phones. This is before email. So she calls me and I'm thinking, oh my God, one of the kids is hurt. Actually, we only had one kid at that point. You know, our son is hurt. Wait, something's going wrong. The house is on fire. What? And she said, I know you've got to go to the show, but we just got our copy of the Los Angeles Times this morning. And Utopia is on the front page of the home section or the entertainment section or whatever it was. The game is on the front page. And there was this huge write-up in the Los Angeles Times about Utopia was the beginning of a new kind of video game. And that was the payoff we were after. And my jaw dropped. I was just kind of like, I still remember that moment of, don't pinch me. I don't want to wake up. You know, 2 years ago, I was teaching school with no prospect of doing this. And then I'd gone into school administration and all these things. And now 2 years later, I get to make games for a living instead of as a hobby. I get to make games with graphics instead of just text. And a game that I made just made the front page of a section in the Los Angeles Times where they're saying, this is great new form of video games. You know, you just, sometimes you can't believe it. You just go, you know, this can't really be happening. You have that moment of, they're going to figure out that I'm just a teacher who programmed mainframe games and I'm not a computer scientist and I haven't done this for a living before. But everybody was learning as they went. You know, I just had that sense of, do I deserve to be here? On one hand, it was incredible and fantastic and all dreams coming true. And on the other hand, it was, I'm not as good as this article says I am. And of course, the article didn't have my name in it because our names were a secret at that time. But, you know, they were talking about the game's design and stuff. They were talking about me indirectly. And I just thought, I know I'm not that good. And how do I live up to this?
Did Mattel encourage you after this great media coverage that you got and probably assuming that the game was commercially successful as well? Did they want you to do more games like Utopia, not necessarily like the same game, but having games which are new and trying stuff that has not been done before?
I think that was a challenge that we've had as a team from the company, was to try to be original and, you know, keep doing new things, because the idea that games would get old and stop selling. In the early days of the industry, you would have a crest of game sales at the beginning, but because the hardware kept selling, even older games continued to sell. So now we think of games, if you don't do DLC and you don't have add-ons and you don't do this or that, you don't have a live services function, you know, a game is going to come and go pretty fast. Back then, we weren't thinking that way. So everything being innovative, each tree in the forest, every game, wasn't expected to fall over quickly. We had to keep planting trees in new places because the old ones were still viable. So that was an overall philosophy for us. And I think that we, as the leaders of the team, Gabriel certainly supported that. I think all five of us at the start supported that philosophy, that thought, as time went on. And as the team grew, then we presented that philosophy to the people. And as Mike Minkoff, who was one of our very finest engineers, he and I each got promoted to lead progressively larger groups and functions. You know, I think we and Gabriel institutionalized that approach. So it was cool. Everybody was encouraged to think that way, not just me. As I got promoted, there were cases where there were specific kinds of things they wanted. And we didn't have somebody with a game like that already ready and pitched and ready to go. So I designed a handful of other games that more junior programmers did as their first project over the course of the next couple of years. But I did the first very basic outline for another game, and then I was promoted, and they said, no, we want you working on admin and design full-time. And I said, oh, I can still code. I mean, I can manage the group you gave me and still code. And they said, no, you don't understand. You can stop coding, Don. It's all right.
It was very realistic. So, do you know sales figures or something?
You know, we did not get access to that data on a constant basis the way you would now. I know it sold over 250,000 copies, but how much of that was sell-in versus sell-through? in retail, I don't know, and how far it went past 250,000. All of the Intellivision and all of the Atari and all of the Activision games, when the industry collapsed at the end of 83, start of 84, there was inventory of all those games sitting, and it's taken quite a while for the retro industry to go through a lot of that old inventory. So for all the games, there were certainly games that were manufactured that were never sold, just because of the rapidity which everything fell apart.
Okay, that's it for today. Don, many, many thanks for your time and the fascinating insights into the development of Utopia. Until next time.
So, das war das Interview. Ich hoffe, es hat euch gefallen. Und jetzt noch die Zusammenfassung. Don Decklow beschreibt im Interview zunächst einmal, wie er in die Branche gekommen ist. Und dazu beginnen wir zur Einordnung mit der Firma Mattel. Mattel ist auch heutzutage noch ein führender Spielzeughersteller. Und damals, Ende der 70er, da verkaufte sich das Atari VCS, die Videospielkonsole von Atari, so gut, dass Mattel gesagt hat, aha, jetzt gibt es hier eine neue Art von Spielzeug offenbar. Und wenn es eine neue Art von Spielzeug gibt, dann wollen wir da mitmachen. Also haben sie so eine Art Test gemacht und haben eine eigene Konsole entwickelt. Das Atari VCS war ja eine 8-Bit-Konsole mit dem 6502-Prozessor. Und das Intellivision hat aber diese Architektur nicht einfach kopiert, sondern eine ganz andere Architektur aufgebaut. Teilweise 8-Bit, teilweise 16-Bit. So eine Art Brücke zwischen den Bit-Generationen. Vielleicht kann man sogar sagen, das war eine halbe Generation voraus dem VCS. Das lief also gut für Mattel. Erste Tests waren vielversprechend. Und dann haben sie das rausgebracht und haben sich erstmal Spiele eingekauft von einem externen Studio. Und dann hatten sie aber vor, eine interne Entwicklungsabteilung zu gründen. Dann schneiden wir kurz um zu Don Decklow, der zu dem Zeitpunkt Lehrer ist, stellvertretender Schulleiter, ist verheiratet, noch sehr jung, ein Kind und ist nicht so richtig zufrieden mit seiner Arbeit, kommt da nicht voran und der hört im Radio eine Werbung für einen Job in der Spielindustrie von Intellivision. Da wird man gefragt, ob man in der aufregenden Welt der Videospiele arbeiten möchte. Und Don Decklow hat zu diesem Zeitpunkt bereits 9 Jahre lang Spiele geschrieben auf Großrechnern. Amateurhaft, ja, also nicht professionell. Aber zu der Zeit gab es ja noch keine Spielebranche. Und dann denkt das ja für mich gemacht. Da wird auch noch eine Telefonnummer durchgesagt und dann bewirbt er sich. Und die können das zuerst nicht fassen, als er da ankommt, dass der 9 Jahre Spielerfahrung haben soll, also Spieleprogrammiererfahrung, aber dann überzeugt er sie und dann stellen sie ihn ein. Und das ist natürlich ein großer Glücksgriff für beide Seiten, ja. Für Don Decklow beginnt jetzt eine schillernde Karriere, ja. Mit diesem einen Radiospot geht es halt los. Und die Firma Mattel kriegt halt einen erfahrenen Programmierer, einen erfahrenen Game Designer, von denen es ja zu der Zeit 1980 noch kaum welche gibt. Intellivision bildet mit Don Decklow und anderen Leuten ein Inhouse-Team, 4 Programmierer und ein leitender Programmierer und das sind dann die, die die First-Party-Spiele entwickeln sollen. Don beschreibt im Folgenden so ein bisschen, wie es da ausgesehen hat. Das ist ein Konzern, das ist jetzt kein kleines Spielestudio, ja, es ist ein 6-stöckiges Gebäude an der Autobahn mit Sicherheitsvorkehrungen, Wachmann davor und so, weil in der Spieleindustrie, da werden Ideen geklaut, da gibt es viel Industriespionage und da muss man halt total aufpassen. Also wenn man da reinkommt, muss man an der Kontrolle vorbei, kriegt so ein Namensschild mit einem Foto drauf, dann wird das immer überprüft und da gibt es halt einen Farbcode da drauf, der die Sicherheitsfreigabe darstellt, ja. Das war also so ein bisschen so, als würde man in eine Militärbasis kommen. Und Don Decklow war ja Entwickler. Das heißt, er hatte die höchste Sicherheitsstufe so hoch wie die anderen Spieleentwickler da im Haus. Also die auch die Puppen und Brettspiele und solche Sachen entwickelten. Das war die höchste Sicherheitsstufe. Und der Arbeitsplatz, der war dann in so einer Art großem Lagerhaus. Und das Lagerhaus war wohl voll mit Spielzeug halt. Man konnte da so durchgehen, da fuhren Gabelstapler rum und so. Und dann kam man in den abgetrennten Bereich der Spieleentwickler, der ein bisschen so aussieht wie spätere Spielestudios auch. Ja, so abgetrennte kleine Kabinen, Cubicles, wie man es in Amerika nennt. Und dann haben sie darin halt gearbeitet. Und das muss so eine richtige, so eine Industrieatmosphäre gewesen sein. Ich meine, halt dieses Lager, die Gabelstapler und dann waren in der Nähe war halt die Entwicklungsabteilung für Fernseher und Handheld-Spiele und da gab es auch ein Testlabor in der Nähe, wo alle Spielzeuge getestet wurden. Wenn man an einem Ende des Raums war, wo die Spieleentwickler drin waren, dann konnte man immer solche Sachen hören wie "Hallo, mein Name ist Barbie" oder das Geräusch eines Autos, das halt ganz oft gestartet wurde oder so. Das war wohl insgesamt dann aber auch eine inspirierende Atmosphäre, weil sie ja auch Zugang hatten und quasi diesen gleichen Rang wie diese Industriedesigner von der Handheld-Spielegruppe. Und die Leute aus dem Intellivision-Bereich, das waren wirklich jetzt anfangs nur Programmierer. Das war ja auch zu der Zeit üblich, ja. Da gab es ja die Gewerke eines Spielestudios noch nicht so. Ja, Audio-Leute und Sound-Leute und Grafiker und Programmierer. Bei denen gab es halt erstmal nur Programmierer. Und dann war es natürlich ganz schön, dass wir in demselben Gebäude, in derselben Firma noch so Industriedesigner hatten, von denen man sich dann beraten lassen konnte oder auf die man auch mal zugreifen konnte, wenn man eine Grafik brauchte. Und sie waren nur 5 Programmierer, aber das war schon quasi zu viel, weil sie hatten nur 2 Entwicklungskits. Und diese Entwicklungskits, da war dann das, auf dem die Spiele überhaupt erst liefen, wenn man sie programmiert hatte. Und die haben sie dann ständig immer rotiert, meinte er. Ja, jeder durfte dann mal ran und gucken, ob sein Spiel noch läuft. Und die programmieren dann in Assembler auf einem proprietären Chip und das konnte Deglow nicht. Er war schon ein erfahrener Programmierer, aber er hat immer Hochsprachen programmiert, also Pascal und Snowball und also wirklich Sprachen, also die Befehle übersetzen. Und Assembler ist ja, da greift man ja auf der Basis von Einzelbits auf den Chip ein, ja, und das ist eine ganz neue Art zu programmieren für ihn und das muss er jetzt erst lernen und das lernt er dann, während er anfängt, Spiele zu schreiben. Das Arbeiten war dann aber wohl ziemlich frei. Der Chef der Gruppe war Gabriel Baum. Der hatte schon ein bisschen Erfahrung in anderen Firmen, war auch älter als Don Deglow. Und der hat seinen Leuten freie Hand gelassen und die ermutigt, einfach Vorschläge zu machen. Ja, jetzt nicht nur irgendwelche Sachen abzuarbeiten, sondern halt auch sich Spiele aktiv auszudenken. Angefangen haben sie aber natürlich mit Sportspielen. Das war so ein bisschen die Spezialität des Intellivision. Ja, ganz viele Sportspiele, weil das ein Genre ist, das man gut abbilden kann und wo man sich auch ein bisschen abheben konnte von dem Atari VCS, das ja im Wesentlichen relativ viele Arcade-Umsetzungen gemacht hat. Und dann haben sie natürlich auch noch Actionspiele dazu gemacht, um mit dem VCS mithalten zu können. Und dann hat Deglow sich gedacht, wir brauchen noch mal was anderes. Und er war ja Lehrer von Haus aus und hatte da durchaus ein bisschen anderen Blick auf die Welt, so wie man Leute unterrichten kann, wie man Wissen vermittelt. Er hat Geografie gemacht und sowas, hat mal eine Karte gemacht mit Isolierband, eine Weltkarte mit Isolierband auf dem Boden der Cafeteria. Und er wollte eher in diese Richtung gehen. Er hatte da auch tatsächlich 1,5 Vorbilder dazu, nämlich ein Spiel namens Hammurabi und ein Spiel namens Santa Peruvia. Santa Peruvia ist gleichzeitig auch das große Vorbild für das deutsche Kaiser von Markus Mergard. Und er hat sich gedacht, na, vielleicht mal so ein Spiel, irgend so ein Spiel, mit dem man so ein Reich verwaltet vielleicht oder auch wirklich den Leuten vielleicht was Geschichtliches vermitteln kann. Das kann man aber natürlich auf so einer Konsole wie dem Intellivision nicht so machen wie auf einem Mainframe-Computer, sondern das muss für das Konsolenpublikum grafisch da sein. Und so kam man dann halt von diesen Textmenüs, wie sie ein Santa Peruvia hat, zu dieser Inseldarstellung, wie Utopia sie hat. Und die Inseldarstellung ist dann ein entscheidender Durchbruch für ihn, weil die Insel ist eine gute Metapher, die schafft Begrenzungen, die schafft einen limitierten Spielraum. Durch das Wasser drumherum ergeben sich Metaphern wie Fischerei und derartige Dinge. Damit geht er dann in die Vollen und schreibt jetzt dieses Spiel, während er noch Assembler lernt. Wir vergessen es nicht. Und er hat natürlich keine Ahnung davon, aber er zeigt seine Fortschritte dem Gabriel Baum, er bespricht seine Fortschritte und seine Ideen in diesem kleinen Team, die gucken sich gegenseitig die Spiele an, spielen die Spiele der anderen, geben sich Feedback und kommen da immer weiter in so einer kreativen Gruppe. Und wie auch später oder vielleicht auch noch teilweise wie heute, ja, wenn es halt Spaß macht, macht Spaß. Und dann kriegt man auch das richtige Feedback aus der Gruppe und dann geht's auch mit dem Spiel weiter. Sie haben noch keine Zielgruppenanalysen zu dieser Zeit und auch keine genauen Daten über die Zielgruppe, aber sie denken sich, dass die Zielgruppe Kinder und Familien sind und versuchen daraufhin zu entwickeln. Und für Don Deglow passt das alles ganz gut, so, ne? Ein Strategiespiel, auch vielleicht ein bisschen intellektuell fordernder als die Sportspiele. Und er baut pädagogische Elemente ein, wie er das nennt, weil er halt Lehrer ist und ihm in das Sujet zu passen scheint. Utopia wird dann das bestbewertete Spiel des Intellivision, also ein Spiel, über das halt viel Furore macht und über das viel geredet wird, das aber keins der drei bestverkauften ist. Wir kommen dann zu dem Controller. Der Controller des Intellivision ist ja ein sehr besonderes Feature. Don Deglow findet den auch heute noch gut, spricht da sehr positiv drüber. Er beschreibt den als einen Controller, der so ein bisschen seiner Zeit voraus war, mit den vielen Möglichkeiten, die man damit hatte, unterschiedliche Steuerungsarten, relativ viele Knöpfe, die gemappt werden konnten, und durch diese Overlays, die man über diese Telefontastatur legen konnte, hatte man auch eine sehr gute Möglichkeit, dem Spieler so ein Lernkonzept nahezubringen. Ja, die mussten nicht die Knöpfe auswendig lernen, so wie das heute ist, sondern konnten halt einfach drauf gucken und sagen gleich, was der Knopf bedeutet. Es war natürlich trotzdem sehr viel komplizierter als das konkurrierende VCS, das ja nur einen einzigen Button hatte auf dem Stick. Aber das war schon ein Alleinstellungsmerkmal. Und für ihn führt das dann eins ganz logisch zum anderen. Er benutzt dann halt wirklich jede Taste des Controllers für sein Spiel. Das ist was, was fast kein anderes Intellivision-Spiel tut. Danach erzählt er ein bisschen über das Design und wie das so Stück für Stück entstanden ist. Ihm war schon irgendwie klar, dass es rundenbasiert sein muss auf eine Art, dass beide Spieler abwechselnd ziehen vielleicht, immer so ein Zug und so, Zeitlimit, und dass man da Punkte für kriegt, und hatte gleich am Anfang die Idee, dass die Punkte basieren sollen auf dem Wohlergehen der Menschen. So hat er halt angefangen, und dann fiel ihm ein, ja gut, aber wenn meine Runde beendet ist, dann sitze ich ja da und warte. Das ist ja ein bisschen blöd. Was wäre denn, wenn ich da noch was tun könnte? Und dann kam er halt drauf, dass es die Fischerboote oder die Torpedoboote geben könnte, mit denen man noch rumfahren kann dann, wenn man seinen eigentlichen Zug, also das Bauen, das Geld ausgeben, wenn man das schon gemacht hätte. Und so könnte man die restliche Zeit besser nutzen, und dann würde man ein bisschen abgelenkt werden, und dann wäre Zeit plötzlich eine Ressource, und das wäre dann ganz interessant. So kamen diese Echtzeitstrategie-Elemente ins Spiel, und damit war er dann echt krass seiner Zeit voraus. Er spricht dann noch ein bisschen generell über Game Design, dass man versuchen soll, Spiele nicht zu komplex zu machen, weil dann der Spieler sich dumm fühlt, wenn er es nicht gleich versteht und so. Und er meint aber, dass zum Beispiel diese Controller des Intellivision genau die richtige Art von Komplexität wären. Er hätte sogar vielleicht noch gerne noch mehr Knöpfe gehabt, aber das war einfach nicht nötig. Das ging schon so, und er fühlte sich dadurch nicht behindert. Wozu er sich schon behindert gefühlt hat, waren halt 4 KB Speicherbegrenzung. Das heißt, das hat sie dazu gezwungen, dieser minimale Speicher für jedes Spiel, hat sie dazu gezwungen, wahnsinnig viel zu optimieren und immer wieder zu optimieren. Das hat sie im Entwicklungsprozess grundsätzlich sehr aufgehalten. Fabian fragt dann im Interview, wie das eigentlich ist, warum das Spiel jetzt keine Gegner-KI hat. Das ist ja ein reines Multiplayer-Spiel, warum man das nicht solo spielen kann. Und dann sagt Don Deglow natürlich folgerichtig, dass man in diese 4K nun wirklich nicht noch eine KI reinbringen könnte. Deswegen ist der Singleplayer-Modus so einfach, indem man einfach die Abwesenheit des anderen Gegners ist. Also das ging einfach nicht anders. Das war den Restriktionen geschuldet. Und dann in dieser Optimierungsphase hat er das Spiel halt einfach gespielt und gespielt und gespielt. Das ist nicht so richtig klar. Es scheint keine eigene Testabteilung gegeben zu haben, sondern die Programmierer haben halt untereinander ihre Spiele wie verrückt gespielt, und er hat halt ja ein vergleichsweise komplexes Spiel für diese Zeit mit Mechaniken, die im Hintergrund laufen, Rechenoperationen und so. Und wenn er da Bugs hat, dann hat er die halt von Hand gesucht, ja, indem er das Spiel gespielt hat und dann mit so einem gelben Block da saß und sich aufgeschrieben hat, was für ein Problem da jetzt ist, und hat auch sein eigenes Spiel beobachtet und dann versucht zu analysieren, indem er zum Beispiel sich die Stürme angeguckt hat, die über die Karte ziehen, und dann ausgezählt hat, wie der Zufallsgenerator da genau funktioniert und wie oft jedes Feld berührt worden ist. Und dann hat er versucht, das einfach so hinzudrehen, dass der Sturm halt fair ist, dass er beide Inseln gleichermaßen berührt und nicht einen Spieler benachteiligt. Anfang 1982 gehen sie dann auf die CES, die Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Die ist immer jedes Jahr im Januar, und da zeigen sie dann das Spiel erstmals. Da kommen dann Händler und Presseleute und Konkurrenten und schauen sich die Spiele an. Und er erhält dann einen Anruf von seiner Frau, Die hat im Hotel angerufen, also Handy gab es ja noch nicht und so und keine E-Mail. Und dann hat er erst einmal Angst gekriegt, weil wenn die Frau da überraschend anruft, hat er Angst, dass irgendwie dem Kind was passiert ist oder so. Aber dann sagt sie nur, dass sie die Los Angeles Times gelesen hat und da auf der Titelseite des Home-Teils ist ein großer Artikel über Utopia als der Beginn einer neuen Art von Videospiel. Und da ist er natürlich sehr begeistert und hat dann so einen Moment, wo er denkt, ey Mann, ey, vor 2 Jahren war ich da noch Lehrer, hatte gar keine Aussicht darauf, irgendwas Besonderes zu machen. Und jetzt bin ich Spieleentwickler und mache Spiele mit Grafik, also nicht nur Spiele mit Text, sondern Spiele mit Grafik und kann das jetzt immer machen. Ja, das ist jetzt mein Leben. Wie toll. Und dann beschreibt er so ein bisschen so ein Imposter-Syndrom-Moment, wo er denkt so, wow, was ist denn eigentlich, wenn die rausfinden, dass ich nur ein Lehrer bin, der Großrechnerspiele programmiert hat und kein Informatiker und dass ich das alles noch nie so richtig beruflich gemacht habe. Aber er hatte schon auch das Gefühl, dass er es verdient, diesen Job zu haben mit seiner Erfahrung und seinen Fähigkeiten. Und das ist doch irgendwie ganz schön. Es geht dann erstmal mit ihm und Intellivision ganz gut weiter. Er wird dann befördert, leitet dann später auch diesen ganzen Bereich der Inhouse-Spieleentwicklung. Dann wird er aber Manager und kann nicht mehr programmieren. Und das ist natürlich immer ein zweischneidiges Schwert. Ja, er macht ja beides grundsätzlich ganz gern, aber geht dann halt schnell in die Management-Karriere. Am Ende haben wir noch gefragt, ob er wisse, wie viel Exemplare das Spiel verkauft hat. Und dann sagt er, nee, er hätte da Zugang zu diesen Daten nicht gehabt. Er meint, es seien 250.000 Exemplare verkauft worden, aber er weiß nicht, wie viel davon wirklich verkauft worden sind an Kunden und wie viel sozusagen nur in den Einzelhandel gekauft worden sind, weil kurz danach kam ja der große Videogame-Crash, wo dann auch wirklich viele Module ja unverkauft verscharrt worden sind. Deswegen weiß er nicht, sind die alle wirklich verkauft worden, die 250.000? Waren es vielleicht sogar noch mehr? Oder sind da einfach auch, waren da auch ein großer Teil dabei, der irgendwie dann vernichtet worden ist, weil die in irgendeinem Lagerhaus saßen und nicht verkäuflich waren? Das war alles. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und macht's gut!